We're going to continue tonight, our last night, talking about great days in the Old Testament. We start with the sixth day of creation. All other days of creation built up to that sixth day where God created man in His own image. And we talked about how Adam woke up twice that day. The first time he woke up in God's presence. The second time he woke up in the presence of his wife that God brought to him. And it was a great day of relationships that were established there. We talked about the day of the Passover. That great deliverance. We looked at some of those 10 plagues and how God delivered His people out of Egypt and through the Red Sea on that great day of the Passover. And how that day was to be celebrated every single year. We looked at the crossing of the Jordan River. And you remember, right as they were crossing the Jordan River, it was the 10th day of the first month, which was when they selected the lamb. After they crossed over, they celebrated that Passover. And the next day, they ate of the fruit of that land, and they no longer had manna. And then we talked about the dedication of the temple last night. And how it was only a 2,700 square foot building, but it was the gold in it was 12 billion plus. We didn't even look at the silver. We didn't look at any of the jewels that went into the cloth, the tapestry, or anything like that. We didn't even start to calculate. We looked at it, it would be the 21st largest company in America. But the payroll, we didn't even consider the payroll, just keeping those guys up, feeding those guys on a regular basis. And whatever wages you were giving those guys, how this was a huge endeavor. And it was a very incredible building. And when we're talking about these stories, we're talking about imagine telling your great-grandkids these stories, these days that you lived through. Today, we're going to talk about another great day. There's actually 2 days here. It's the 14th and the 15th days of Adar, which were celebrated and still celebrated today, to some degree. It's the story of Esther. Now, I'll be honest with you. Esther is quickly becoming one of my favorite stories in the entire Bible. Every time I read this book, I am fascinated with how God works. And you can't help but be amazed at how God works behind the scenes. Nobody knows what He's doing. And He causes things to happen in just the way that He wants them to happen. And then boom, all of a sudden, He brings His plan to life. And there's usually great celebration when God's plans come together. So, I love this book. We're going to look at this book. We're going to look at a lot of different aspects of this book. And we're going to hopefully be encouraged. Brother Gary pointed out one thing. I told you that one of the things I would like to do, or hopefully accomplish during this week, is to rejuvenate our love for Bible stories. I know we all like Bible stories, but just the pure fascination that is there as you read these stories, and you tell these stories to non-Christians, as we tell these stories to one another, and as we tell these stories to children. But we're told in the New Testament that faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. I hope that studying these great days in the Bible has built our faith. It has helped us to realize how great God is. And how God does come through. And how when we rely on Him, when we trust Him, when we do things His way, we might not see things as clearly as we should sometimes. Like the Israelites, they didn't see things clearly all the time. But ultimately, when we put our trust in God, God makes everything work out. And another point that we haven't talked about that I think it is worth mentioning is that sometimes it just takes one person to make a huge difference. And isn't that what Moses did? God was ready to wipe them all out on multiple occasions. And it took one person with the faith and the love for God's people to stand in the gap and say, God, please do something different. And it happened in Moses' life a couple times. All right, before we get into the actual point number one, which is the plot to kill the Jews, we've got to lay a little groundwork here. Different ways to pronounce the guy's name. Even Vashti, we call her Vashti. Really, it's not really the correct way to pronounce it, but we're going to call her Vashti because that's what we're used to. Ahasuerus, that's what we're going to call the king because that's what we're used to. Well, he has this great feast. It lasts 180 days. 6 months of feasting and celebrating. Things were pretty good. They were drinking out of gold cups, and none of the gold cups looked alike. So everybody had gold cups to drink out of, and none of our cups looked alike. And it just shows the wealth of that particular nation at that particular time. Well, after the 180-day feast, they have another 7-day feast where the king is making merry with a bunch of his friends, and the queen, Queen Vashti, is having a feast of her own. Well, they're drinking a little bit. At the end of these 7 days, the king decides he wants to show off the beauty of his queen. And so he calls for her. Go get my wife. Go get Queen Vashti. Bring her to me. And she refuses to come. And so he's embarrassed. And when the party's over, they're talking about this with all of his counselors. What are we going to do? And the counselors say, hey, you know what, king? She didn't only disregard you, but she really put all of us men in a tight spot. Okay? Because if the queen is able to get by with this, then all the other women in town and all of your kingdom, they're going to say, hey, we don't have to do what our husbands tell us to do. And but if you make some kind of a decree, if you take her queenship away from her, then everybody will know that the wife is to honor the husband. And that sounds good to him. So he did. He took the queenship away from her, and everybody in all of his kingdom knew that, hey, the wife needed to respect her husband. Well, he wants another wife, right? He wants another queen. So his advisors come up with this plan. Let's get all the beautiful women from all of the virgins from all over your kingdom, and let's bring them here, and you can pick any of them that you want to be your wife. Well, Esther's actually living in the capital city, so she lives there close. She is one of the women that is picked to go before the king. Now, this is major and it's fascinating. The women each got 1 year to prepare themselves before they went into the king. So 6 months to purify themselves, to beautify themselves, and then 6 months to make sure they smelled good. And so at the end of 1 year, they would go into the king. And if the king liked them or not, if he liked them, he might call for them again. If not, she would go live in a certain place in the palace and may never see the king again. So that's just the setting that we have right now when we're introduced to Esther. Let's read Esther chapter 2 and verse 17. The king loved Esther more than all the other women. So he'd seen all these other women. He saw Esther. And she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants. And he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. So after 12 months of Esther beautifying herself, she went into the king and she was chosen by the king. Now it's interesting if you read that, that all the other women, that once you went into the king, you could take whatever you want to go with you. Whatever was in the household, you could take to go with you to go meet the king. Esther didn't take anything special. She just went to the king with the normal provisions that were given for her to go to the king. So she goes in, and she is chosen to be queen to take the place of Vashti. So, you think God had anything to do with that? Can you imagine this girl? Her mom and dad had died. She was raised by someone else, and now she finds herself the queen. Now, the queen didn't quite mean like we think the queen means, and we'll find that out as the story progresses. She wasn't sitting next to the king every day, but she is the queen now. But what happens, they come together again later. Let's look at Esther chapter 2 and verse 19, because this is key to the story. This is going to come back later. When virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gates, he finds out that there are two eunuchs who decide to kill the king. Verse 22, so the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. So Esther does go before the king on this occasion, and she tells the king, hey, Mordecai tells me that there is a plot to kill you. Well, the king sends out people to find out if this is true, and this is true. There was a plot to kill the king, and so the king has these guys executed for this plot that they had. So Mordecai uncovered a plot to kill the king. Now, it says that this was recorded in the book of Chronicles, not our Chronicles, but the books of that king's Chronicles. And so it was recorded there, and that comes by a little bit later. Now, Haman was somebody who the king had promoted to the level where he was basically, when I think about Haman, I think about basically online with Joseph of Egypt. He was way up there in the king's palace. The king had given him a bunch of stuff. He had a lot of power. The king had really put a lot in his understanding. In Esther chapter 3 and verse 2, it says, "Now all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not do it." So just get this picture here. Haman is this guy, he has a lot of pride. He loves being in this position. He loves it. Could you imagine us walking outside and everybody bowing down to you? Do you just see that? Do you see that sense? I mean, just thinking about it makes your chest pop up out a little bit and your shoulders back. Everybody comes and bows to you. And you imagine walking in this room and everybody was bowing down to you, except there was this one guy over there that wouldn't bow down to you. Oh, that just ate Haman up. He hated that. And it burned him up. And even so, that some of the servants would go over to Mordecai and say, "Mordecai, listen, you are violating the command of the king. You need to bow down to this man. This is what the king has said to do." But he refused to do it. Now, I don't know about you, but most of us could probably live with that if everybody was bowing down to us except one person. But not him. He was so upset about this that it says that Haman became furious when Mordecai refused to bow down to him. And he became so furious that he decided to enact revenge by having all the Jews killed. So it wasn't just that he wanted to tell the king, "Hey, let's kill Mordecai." He wanted to enact this law so that all of the people that were related to Mordecai would be killed, not just Mordecai. So, I mean, this is an evil man that we're dealing with, and his plot just goes deeper and deeper and deeper. And so he goes to the king, and he tells the king, "Hey, there's this nation under your control that their customs are weird. They don't do what normal people do. They don't obey the king like they're supposed to obey the king. We got to get rid of this whole nation." And the king basically takes off his ring, hands it over to Haman, says, "You write the law." Of course, Haman does say, "Let's make sure this law can't be reversed." And so Haman is put in charge of writing this law that he is about to write. Let's look at Esther chapter 3 and verse 12. "When the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all people, to every province according to its script, and to every people in their language. In the name of the king it was written, and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions." Now, how did Haman pick this day? Well, he picked this day by lot. He chose the day of the Jewish execution by lot. I don't know how that lot was chosen, but somehow they were picking by chance, and it showed up this month, this day is the day of execution. We're in the first month. So there goes by, some writers say, 8-9 months or so go by with all of the Jews thinking that on this particular day, they're meeting their demise. They are going to die. So he picked that one day. On this day, all Jews were to be killed and their possessions were to be plundered. So if you saw a Jew, you didn't like a Jew, you go, you kill him, you take his things. This is a serious day. But I want you to, just one thing as we've been talking about this. The Jews started receiving the news of their total destruction the day the Passover lamb was scheduled to be killed. The decree was written on the 13th day. Now, Esther lived in the capital city, as did Mordecai. So you have to figure the Jews in the capital were, because it says they passed it out as quickly as possible by courier to get it out to as many people as possible as they could. So they write the decree on the 13th day of the first month. On the 14th day of the first month, when the Passover lamb was scheduled to be executed, is when the Jews started getting news that they were all going to be annihilated in several months, 11 months from now. Now, I don't think they were keeping the Passover at that time. If they were keeping the Passover at that time, I would think that this day wouldn't be the doom and gloom day that they thought it would be. They had forgotten about all the deliverance God had given them in the past. Because the reaction to this isn't, okay, we're eating the Passover lamb today, God delivered us in Egypt, God delivered us going across the river of Jordan, God's going to deliver us here either. That's not the reaction. The reaction is one of total fear. And I can't imagine being afraid that if I knew that on one day, everybody in the province was coming to get my people, and there's a good chance that we're all going to be annihilated. I mean, this is a nasty decree, isn't it? I want you to kill all the men. I want you to kill all the little children. I want you to kill the women. I want all of these Jews executed and killed. So this day is going to be a terrible day, as far as we know now. It's not going to be a good day. Well, in Esther chapter 4 and verse 13, we know that Esther had seen Mordecai out in sackcloth. And she couldn't go out there. She had to send word, find out what's going on. She finds out what's going on. And this conversation takes place between messengers where she basically says, hey, look, there's nothing I can do about this. I cannot go into the king. And Mordecai has words for her. In chapter 4 and verse 13, Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than any or all of the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go, gather all the Jews who are present at Shushan, this is the capital, this is where they live, and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. I mean, that's just incredible. I mean, that passage of Scripture, I don't think we read it every day, we couldn't hurt ourselves, could we? Mordecai says a couple things here that are so important. One is, you're not going to escape if you keep quiet. The second is, God is going to deliver His people. To make no mistake about it, Esther. So you just got to pick if you're going to be part of that deliverance or if you're not going to be part of that deliverance. The same is true today. Right? God is going to do great things today. And you have to decide if you're going to be part of God's plan to do these great things or if you're going to be against God. But God will be glorified. Have we not read enough Bible stories that teach us that God's going to make sure everybody knows who He is? Everybody will know who He is. And so we can take part in that. That's the great thing. He says another thing. Who knows whether or not you were brought to this position right now for this particular reason? Now, Esther might have thought that she was picked because she was the prettiest. She smelt the best. She had the best personality. I think she was picked because God needed her there. You can even go farther than that. Maybe God made Esther beautiful for that particular reason. He knew he was going to need a beautiful woman in that place, in that time, in order to capture the king's eye, in order to save his people. So Esther could have owed all of her good looks to the fact that God needed her on this particular day and on this particular occasion to do this particular task. But Esther was willing to risk her life to save God's people. I can't imagine the courage it had to take for her. Now, you notice what she said? She asked them to fast for 3 days. Has anybody here ever gone without food for 3 days other than a medical reason? 3 days. You chose to go without food for 3 days. Anybody go without water for 3 days? This is a serious day. They are scared. And then they were so scared that they chose to fast for 3 days, no food, no water. Now this is pushing the limits on going without water, right? And so that's how desperate they were on this particular occasion. She says, you fast, Mordecai, get all the Jews together to fast. Me and my maidservants will fast as well. The next day when she goes out into the courtyard of the king. And she's in serious, dangerous territory here. Because if the king does not extend to her his golden scepter, she's probably dead. Can you imagine what's going through her mind at this time? It doesn't appear to me. Some stories we have in the Bible, there are stories of brave characters like David. Do you sense any fear whatsoever in David's voice as he goes before Goliath? I don't. But I sense a little bit of hesitancy in Esther. A little bit of nervousness as she goes before the king, knowing that the king has the right to take her life. Well, luckily for her, as the king sees her, she was beautiful, and it delighted the king that she had come. So he reaches out his scepter, she comes, she bows down, and she touches his scepter. And she said, Esther. He said, Esther, what do you want? Some of these kings throw around this half my kingdom thing, you know, that Herod threw around that half my kingdom thing later. But he goes, whatever you want, up to half my kingdom, and it will be yours. And she says, I want you and Haman to come to a feast that I have prepared for you. Well, it's so funny. You just got to go read it again. Because it's almost like the king can't wait to go to this feast. And so he sends it. Somebody go get Haman quickly. We got a feast to go to. Esther has made us this incredible feast. So I just sense the excitement in his face as he sent her to go on this particular occasion. At that particular banquet. One day they have this banquet. And at that banquet the king asks, Esther, what is it? What do you want? It's killing me. The suspense is driving me nuts. What do you want? I have to have my kingdom and it's yours. And she said, if it pleases the king, I would like for you and Haman to come to another feast that I'm going to prepare for you tomorrow. All right. So he said, all right, we'll do it. So that night, that very night, between the two feasts, Haman goes home, and as he leaves the king's palace, everybody starts bowing down to him, right? Except Mordecai. He leaves and he sees Mordecai, and he is just burning up. And he says to his guys, don't say anything to him, it's okay. So he goes home. He invites all of his family, all of his friends to his house. And he's showing them everything he has. Look, I got a bunch of good kids. And I got this huge palace, and I got a wonderful wife, and I have all, look at all my treasures. He's showing all his treasures to all of his friends, really bragging about how much he's accomplished in his life. He says, besides that, Queen Esther invited me and the king to a feast today, and she's having another feast tomorrow, and guess who's invited? Just the king and me, we're invited. But he said, none of this avails me anything as long as Mordecai is still sitting in the king's gate. Could you imagine hating someone that much? That you could have all this stuff. That you should be the most content person in the world. You should be so happy with all the blessings that you have. And yet, because you are so vengeful, because you resent one person so much, that is ruining your life. It is eating you up on the inside. Well, that night after he tells all his friends that hey, everything's great in my life except that Mordecai guy. His wife says, well, I have an idea for you. Make some gallows. 50 cubits high, that's about 75 feet high. And tomorrow, go to the king and tell the king to hang a Mordecai on those gallows. So, they must have worked on those gallows all night long. I don't know how long it would take to build something like this, but they only have one night to do it, right? Because they had the feast today, and they're having another feast tomorrow. So that night, he must have had laborers out there building these gallows. Maybe as he's that night, as he's walking, he can't sleep because he's so excited about going to this feast. He's looking out his window, and he sees they're making progress on these gallows, and he just can't wait till tomorrow when he's finally going to be able to enjoy his life and everything that he has, because Mordecai's going to be dead. It's going to be wonderful. Everything in my life is going to be great once Mordecai is dead. Well, the tables start to turn that night, and Haman has no clue. Really, nobody has any clue except God about what's taking place. Now remember, we're in between the two feasts, and the king is can't sleep. Esther's come in, gave him a big feast. What do you want? She's not telling. Playing a little hard to get here. He says, well, what do you want? She goes, come back the next day and I'll tell you the next day. So he has a hard time sleeping. That same night that Mordecai is developing these plans to kill, Haman is developing these plans to kill Mordecai. He's overseeing the gallows being built. That night, God makes it where the king can't sleep. And so that night, the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. God works in ways we cannot see. Is it any coincidence that he couldn't sleep? I don't think so. Is it a coincidence that he called for the book to be read? I don't think so. Is it a coincidence that they were reading from this particular passage? I don't think so. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of the plot by these two eunuchs, the doorkeepers, who had sought to lay hands on the king. Verse 3, then the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. So, I know I've stressed this a couple times, but I can hardly read this story without putting a grin to my face, okay? The same night the king could not sleep, he took the book and read in the book of the Chronicles. He discovered that Mordecai had never been rewarded for saving his life. So the king has had this read, and he's thinking, man, Mordecai, that's a good guy. That guy saved my life. What have we done for that guy? We haven't done anything for that guy. Well, that's a shame. We ought to do something for that guy. If anybody deserves some praise, it ought to be Mordecai. While Haman is building the gallows, on his way to see the king, he probably walked right by him. Oh, that's 75 feet, man. He's going to be hanging high today. Somebody told me, Brother Bingham's not here, he goes, his mom used to have a saying when they did something bad, I'm going to hang you higher than Haman. And so that's the saying that went on. I'm going to hang you higher than Haman. It means you're in serious trouble if you do something like that. But here he's looking at this gallows. Oh, they're so high. He's going into the king. And the king says, who's out there? Who's in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king should hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. So he just walked into the court. I'm going to go tell that king to kill Mordecai. The king says, hey, who's out there? Hey, they said, Haman's out there. He says, well, come on in here, Haman. So Haman came in, and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? So the next morning, he comes in to suggest that Mordecai be killed. Before he can make the suggestion, the king says, hey, come on in here. What do you think? What do you think I should do to a guy that I wish to show honor to? Oh, Haman. What does Haman think? Haman thinks, who in the world in this kingdom deserves more honor than I do? And so he comes up with the most elaborate, greatest, best plan to honor a man that he could possibly think of. Oh, yeah, you got to put him in these special clothes. You got to get him on a special horse. You got to make sure everybody knows that this is a special horse that the king's been on at some point. And you got to have somebody walk him around the entire town saying, this is what happens to a man that the king wishes to honor. In Esther chapter 6 and verse 10, then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robe and the horse as you have suggested, and so do for Mordecai the Jew who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken. I mean, could you? I can't even begin to imagine the change in facial expressions that happened in this man. He's like, yeah, you put a robe on him and you put him on the horse. And the king says, quickly, do so to Mordecai. And so he goes out. And he goes and does just like the king says. And Haman ends up honoring Mordecai instead of killing him. Haman is the guy that was walking by the horse. While Mordecai is being arrayed in special clothing, Haman is the guy that is walking with his horse saying, this is what happens to the one that the king wishes to honor. I mean, we know from the book of Nehemiah that you can't enter the king's presence looking sad, really, right? Because when Nehemiah looked sad, the king noticed it. And Nehemiah said, I was scared because I had never looked sad in the king's presence in my entire life. If the king tells you to go out and honor this guy, do you think you can walk around like this? This is what happens to the guy. You can't do that. I mean, you have to yell at the top of your lungs. You have to make them believe that you want this man to be honored. When he's done with this, he runs home. He runs home, buries his face, and he is upset. And his wife is like, what's wrong? He's like, oh, it's Mordecai. Can you just imagine? It's Mordecai, the one that we built those gallows for. The king just made me walk all over town with a horse, with him on it, telling him how great this guy is. And his wife basically says, you're in trouble. Man, if this Mordecai is a Jew, then you are in some serious trouble because there's nothing you're going to be able to do at this point. You basically, not that she actually came up with a plan, remember? But she basically tells him, you're in a lot of trouble here. And it actually turns out that later on, Haman is delaying coming to the feast. That the king has to send to get him again. He's like, go get Haman and tell him it's time for the queen's feast. So you have the king excited about this feast. Now you have Haman coming down off this high. He's upset. But again, he has to show a good pretense when he goes before the king, right? He has to put a smile on his face. You ever tell your kids, put a smile on your face, kid. I don't care if you're happy or not. Just make them think you're happy. All right, that's why he has to go in. He has to go in with everybody thinking that he's happy. Esther chapter 7 verse 1. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And on the second day, at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, what is your petition, queen? It shall be granted. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom. It shall be done. Now this, what we're about to read, facial expressions might rival the facial expressions that he had when the king told him to honor Mordecai. Because the queen answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue. Now, I think that's significant in of itself. She's saying, look, it's only come to this point because we've actually been sold to be killed. If somebody would have developed a plan to sell us into slavery, I wouldn't have said anything. But Haman's overzealousness is what's getting him in trouble. I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could have never compensated for the king's loss. So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Esther, who is he? And where is he? Who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? Haman had to, at this point, be sweating bullets. And this pretty little girl from Israel turns and says, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. The king is so upset he leaves the palace and goes out to the court. He needs a few minutes. He's upset. Well, the Esther tells that King Haman is the wicked man responsible for putting him in such a desperate situation. So the king goes out. He's trying to cool off a little bit before he comes back in. And Haman, now just think about this for a second. He had already had plots to kill Esther, really, and all the Jewish people. He's this great, mighty man that everybody bowed down to. He throws himself on Esther's lap. Begs Esther for his very life. The king came in. And he's even more upset. What? Now you make advances on the queen? When I walk out of the room? And it said, no, in Esther 7 and verse 8, as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now one of the eunuchs said to the king, look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. That's an amazing story already, isn't it? I mean, how the turn of events, God working behind the scenes, everything working out just like God had planned. Well, you still have a huge dilemma here, don't you? The law has already been passed. The Jews are already facing a day of annihilation. And it was the Medes and the Persians, the law couldn't be reversed. And so, what the king does is he actually gives Mordecai all of Haman's possessions. He gives Mordecai Haman's house. He gives Mordecai everything that Haman had. He gives Mordecai the power. And Mordecai has risen now up the ranks to be where Haman was. And so he's a very powerful man at this particular time in the nation's history. So the king allowed them to make another law. Look at Esther chapter 8 and verse 15. So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. And in every province, the city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews, because fear of the Jews fell upon them. So Mordecai wrote this decree basically saying, when on that day, when the people rise up to kill the Jews can in turn kill whoever hates them. And they can plunder their possessions. Now if you're a Jew, you're getting this message and you're ecstatic. You're glad that now this day of destruction is not going to be a day of destruction. Now we get a chance to fight back. And a couple things I want to notice from this passage before we let the kids in. One is, look where Mordecai came from. Where was he when he heard about this day? When he heard what was going to happen in the 13th month of the year, in the month of Adar, the 14th day, what did he do? What was he wearing after this? Sackcloth, right? Now what's he wearing? He's wearing purple, linen, and gold. I mean, everything. This is totally different than what he had been wearing before. He had become a man that had a lot of power. There was a feast and a holiday. Now, this is key right here. Well, we'll all hit this at the very end. Then many of the people of the land became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them. The decree went out that the Jews were able to defend themselves. When the decree was read, the people rejoiced and declared a holiday. All right, we'll stop there and let the kids come in. All right, we're going to pick up where we left off in the adult class for just a minute. The decree has gone out that the Jews now have the right to defend themselves. And when the decree was read, all the people rejoiced. Well, in Esther chapter 9 and verse 1, now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. Now remember, it was on the 13th day of the first month that the first law was passed. that the Jews could be annihilated. So the Jews have had all this time to dread this day until the law that Mordecai had passed was finally read to them. On that day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But the opposite occurred. And that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. The Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the province of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought them harm. And no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all people. What did we talk about when we were talking about the Jordan River crossing? That everybody on the west side of the Jordan, all these nations were scared to death of the people of Israel. And we talked about it's so much easier to defeat people who think they're going to be defeated, right? Who are afraid of you. And so here they come over, they're starting to fight, and they're having this huge victory. Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. So instead of being overpowered, the Jews overpowered those who hated them. And they had victory. They killed these people who had sought them so much harm. Well, in chapter 9, verse 20, and Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews near and far who were in the provinces over King Ahasuerus. So what happens here is she asked for another day. The king says, what do you want, Esther? Here's the report. Here's how many people are dead. I let you do what you wanted. All these people are dead. What do you want now? And she goes, well, please, the king, can we have one more day? One more day to go avenge our enemies? And so he says, you got it. So they had another day where the Jews could go and avenge their enemies. And again, they had great success and they overpowered their enemies again. And then Mordecai wrote these words and sent letters to all the Jews near and far who were in all the provinces of the king, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and the 15th days of the month as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted the custom which they had begun as Mordecai had written to them. Now there's a very important word that comes next. Because. Because Haman, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them and had cast basically lots to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letter that this wicked plot which Haman had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged in the gallows. This great day, or these great days of victory and celebration, happened because Haman plotted against the Jews. Think about that for a second. These days never happened if Haman hadn't decided he wanted to kill all the Jews. Before you could have the holiday and the celebration, you had to have the plot. And I find it so ironic when I read this, and I can't help, like I said, to read it with a little grin, that Haman sought out to annihilate the Jews. And what did we read earlier? Earlier in chapter 8 and verse 17, at the end of that verse, it says, then many of the people of the land became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them. What did Haman want to do? He wanted to wipe out Jews. And so he developed this foolproof plan in order to do it. He was the king's second man in charge. I'm going to wipe out all the Jews. And at the end of the day, there are more Jews than there were to begin with. That's why God works. Whenever people plot against God, the opposite usually happens. Over and over in the Bible, I want this to happen. You know, there's so many stories that can remind you of this. We've talked a little bit about when Jehoshaphat built the golden calf. The reason for that was that people from the north wouldn't go to the south. Well, regardless of how many golden calves he built, God blessed the south so much, the people in the north moved to the south. There was nothing they could do about it. The very thing he was trying to avoid, the opposite happened. He was trying to wipe this out, and it happened. When Joseph walks up to his brothers, they say, "Look, here comes the dreamer. Let us take care of the dreamer and we'll see what happens to his seeking dreams." But they didn't do. Their intent was to make those dreams not come true. They were determined. We'll do whatever it takes to make those dreams that dreamer dream not come true. And then years later, what did they find themselves doing? They found themselves bowing down to their brother Joseph. Brothers and sisters, God's plan is going to come true. What's going to happen at the end of day, at the end of time? Every knee is going to bow to God. I'm talking to a brother about an atheist. An atheist says there is no God. What's going to happen at the end of time? That atheist is going to be on his knees. He is going to be bowing down to Jesus Christ. The book of Philippians says, every knee will bow. Every tongue will confess. Those in heaven, those on earth, those under the earth. God is going to win, guys. I hate to spoil the end for you, but God wins every time. And what we have a choice right now is, you have a choice what side you want to be on. You know, if you're picking up teams in the playground, and if I were to tell you, that team's going to win, and that team's going to get annihilated, what team would you typically pick to be on? The winning team, right? That's a very crude example. Here we have all eternity is there. God and His saints are going to reign in heaven forever. And the people who don't choose to bow their knee to God right now are not going to make it. And there's nothing you can do about that. You cannot stand in God's way. The best thing you could do is totally submit your life to Him right now. So if you have not submitted your life to Him, you need to become a Christian. If you're of age and you know what you need to do, you need to submit to what God says. God says if you believe and you're baptized, Jesus said you're going to be saved. You're not going to be saved unless you believe in Jesus and you're baptized. There's no two ways about it. You have to do it God's way. You have to follow God's plan. And so I implore you, I beg you, if you've not done that, do that. It's simple. But the implications are incredible and they're eternal. And you're a Christian. I hope that we've helped this week build our faith. I hope that we've helped this week restore in us a love for God's book and a love for God's stories. And I hope we walk out a little bit more secure that we're on the winning side. And that we can hold our head up a little bit more, and we can hold our shoulders back and hold our chest out, knowing that God's on our side. And if the God that created everything and man and day six after His own image, if the God that had the Passover, where the blood was applied in Passover and the Israelites escaped through the Red Sea, if the God that allowed the children of Israel to walk through the Jordan River on dry land, the God who they built this incredible temple to, whose glory left the tabernacle and filled the temple, and His glory was so amazing the priests couldn't keep working in there, they had to leave. And the God who does this that we read today is the God that you serve. He's just as powerful today as He was then. He is helping Christians just as much today as He was then. And this is what I want you to remember. The Bible is complete revelation, no question about it. And God's not going to give us anything else. But God's stories are still being written every day. I'm in God's story. Every day I wake up as a participant in God's story. When you wake up tomorrow morning, you wake up a participant in God's story. The story hasn't ended just because the Bible is done being written. God is still acting today, still working today in our lives. So please realize that, what's your story saying? If there were going to be something else written, God would write about you. Where's He going to find you? Is He going to find you on His side or standing against Him? Let's be with Him. And let's remember, God's still writing His stories. He's writing them every day. And we are the actors. We're the participants in those stories. Everybody, as we stand and sing this last song, I want everybody here to commit their lives to the Lord stronger than they had before. Everybody who sings out this song, I want you singing it as if I am going to follow God more tomorrow than I ever have in my past. And if you need to make special attention, you need us to pray for you, if you need us to be baptized, you can come right now as we stand and sing.